Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile, and smart speaker. This is Upfront on Love Sport.
You're listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 till 3 p.m. on Love Sport Radio.
This is Love Sport.
The second week of an international break. Thursday is traditionally what I call Black Thursday because it's a complete dead day of news. Nothing ever happens. I woke up in the morning, I texted my producer and I went, oh, Ben, what are we going to talk about today? And then, like manna from heaven, Manchester United send us a press release saying we're about to announce Ole Gunnar Solskjaer as our new permanent manager. And of course, most people were delighted about it. Almost every United fan I spoke to, while some had misgivings about the timing, the majority of them were absolutely delighted to see a genuinely popular manager installed. Because realistically, David Moyes, I think, was an uninspiring choice. Louis van Gaal was an extremely unpopular man, played some of the most boring football any Premier League manager's ever played. Manchester United accumulated 3,222 backwards passes in his last season in charge of the club. That's not good. I mean, look, I'm a fan of keeping the ball, but backwards passing is not what you pay £75 a ticket to watch at Old Trafford, is it? And then, of course, Jose Mourinho. I don't need to remind you what sort of manager he was. So United fans, jubilant, of course, to have someone in charge who they like, who's a legend of the club, understands the way Manchester United works, and crucially understands the way the fans works as well. And it's hard to argue that he doesn't deserve that chance to lead United into the next Premier League campaign. So I'm not necessarily going to argue with the decision to give him the job. The first few victories he had edged him closer to that idea. And then, of course, that miracle in Paris practically printed his name on the contract, frankly. And there's a lot of feel-good factor around Old Trafford at the moment, as there should be. The players have been campaigning for Solskjaer to get the job for months. The fans have been singing his name with that really annoyingly catchy tune. It's just so catchy, honestly. There's only one Man United fan in the entire office, and anyone can start singing that at any time, and it's in your head all day. It's infuriating. But they've been singing it for months. And now the players are behind him, the board are behind him. If the Sun are to be believed, and credit where credit's due, Neil Custer's got this right 6 weeks ago, they said they'd made their mind up in early February. So Solskjaer's a little bit unusual, actually, if you look around top-level management, partly because he's only been doing it for about 5 minutes, but also because he's quite softly, softly catchy monkey with his style. If you talk to any of the senior players at Manchester United, the likes of Ander Herrera, for example, he says he doesn't give them too many instructions. He sort of sends out the veterans anyway, knowing that they know what to do, knowing that they know how to take care of games. And I often think that football management is a game of less, not more. You don't want to overcomplicate things for your players. If you give them too much information, too many instructions, A, they're young. Footballers are young. They're all under 30, for goodness sake. That's basically child. They generally don't have a lot going on, and they need simple instructions that they can deal with. And in that sense, Solskjaer's a really big improvement, I think, on the likes of Louis van Gaal, who gave them so much information that they were just frozen by paralysis by analysis, frankly. Jose Mourinho froze his players, but more with fear and then eventually just malaise. So Solskjaer's a big step up, but it's still a gamble. It's a punt. It's a leap of faith. And I think they have to remember that. It's not necessarily the top-level manager people would have wanted even 3 months ago. That was when Zinedine Zidane and Mauricio Pochettino were top of the list. Gareth Southgate's name was even thrown around pretty outrageously in some tabloid newspapers. Solskjaer wouldn't have had a fart in hell's chance of getting a job anywhere else, anything like the level of Manchester United. Now, Matt Dickinson points this out rather shrewdly in the Times this morning. Bayern Munich and Juventus were hardly likely to sit up and think, that Molde manager's doing all right, maybe we should give him a go. It's true. He wasn't in the running for any of those other jobs because of where he'd been managing and what he'd done at Cardiff. So let's not forget that this is a gamble. The safe option would have been Mauricio Pochettino, but that would have cost him apparently £50 million to get him out of his Spurs contract. And while he's good, he might not be £50 million good. So they've got their man, they've handed him a £5 million a year contract, and now they have to treat him wisely and use him wisely. Just because there are 3 years on his deal doesn't mean they won't sack him. We've seen so many managers get sacked on big contracts, of course. So they need to give him those precious commodities, those commodities which are time and money. There's no point in sacking Ole Gunnar Solskjaer before Christmas? I think it's not that unlikely to happen, but there's no point in doing it. His managerial style is clearly one where he tries to curb players. He doesn't want to bend them. He doesn't want to break them and then rebuild them. He just wants to chip away at them. And he won't change the team overnight. I know the results between his reign and Jose Mourinho's reign did change very quickly overnight, but Solskjaer has just started putting square pegs in square holes. Mourinho spent months forcing these players into ill-fitting systems, like squeezing a slightly overweight radio presenter into an undersized pair of jeans, which I'm very familiar with for obvious reasons. Can Solskjaer succeed at a top club? Very maybe. Can Manchester United make themselves do whatever they have to do to let him? That's my worry, and worry the club won't be able to stomach the reality.
Love Sport.
It's time to speak to ex-Spurs, Manchester City and Fulham midfielder Michael Brown. And the reason is, well, a number of reasons, but there's good news for Tottenham fans this week. Of course, the new stadium's opening, and of course that's exciting. But also, Manchester United aren't going to try and poach their manager anytime soon. Michael, that must be a huge relief for anyone involved with Tottenham.
It looks much better for the Tottenham supporters, as we well know. Real Madrid taken, and now obviously Manchester United. I think what for me was, it was there was no real no that he wasn't going there. There was no quotes, and obviously Maurizio Pochettino had had some. He sort of got a little bit angry the last few weeks over certain ways he could take the club, and he said if you want another miracle man, you might need to look somewhere else. So I thought, would that happen? But great news for Spurs that hopefully he'll be there for next season, the opening of the stadium.
Do you think there might be some rather honest words spoken between Poch and Levy over the next couple of weeks? Levy perhaps reasonably saying, look, mate, you never said no. We could have done with you saying, actually, look, I'm not going to take the United job. And equally, Poch saying, well, I didn't say no because you haven't given me any money. That honest conversation must have to happen at some point, hasn't it?
It's a difficult one because you're always looking and saying, as a manager, what do you turn down? You don't know what the football club wants to do with you as well, and how much trust they've got with yourself. So you always actually leave that door slightly open in any opportunity. But he's done a fantastic job, and the stadium now is the key for me, for the Spurs supporters. I'm looking forward to the game against Manchester City. I'm going to be there the night before the training, and then obviously for the game pitch side. So I'm really, really looking forward to such a fabulous stadium. I'm sure it's going to be a great atmosphere that the Spurs supporters have had to wait a long time for.
I take it that Spurs fans were a bit disappointed with that Champions League draw. I'm sure you, having grown up as a Man City player and played for Tottenham, were delighted that was the two teams that came out the hat together.
Oh, it's a great draw for me personally. Two of my old clubs, the latter stages of the Champions League and the new stadium, as we've mentioned. But yes, it was a draw that the Spurs supporters have probably wanted to avoid. They know what Manchester City can bring to the table and the strength and depth that they do have. But it's a game they can win. And let's know that I think the White Hart Lane is going to give them a huge boost in the first leg. Bobby Strange is also playing them in the league, so they should know each other very, very well by the end of it.
Yeah, quite. Are you a City fan, Michael? Is that your team?
Listen, I love Manchester City. They gave me my debut. It was so I still go there now. I'm still looked after very well. My boy's a City supporter. I've been very fortunate to play for some fantastic clubs, and I'm always one now is I follow all the clubs I've played for, and it's a real honour really that I've been able to play for some fantastic clubs.
That's a very diplomatic answer. I'm very impressed. Well, one of those clubs, of course, is Fulham, and there's a fan protest planned for tomorrow over ticket prices, which the club are trying to shut down. They're trying to keep the banners out of the ground. Now, Fulham have, and this is to do with the matchday tickets, not the season tickets, they've got, I believe, the third most expensive, cheapest ticket in the ground. Does that surprise you that a club like Fulham, relatively small ground, not always been in the Premier League, are charging those sorts of prices?
It's a difficult one, because once they go into the Premier League, they're going to sell out, so they know that the revenue will be brought in. The supporters, obviously the ones who can't afford it, that's the difficulty of being with them for many years. So there's got to be some balance there, and you do feel for the supporters, but also the football club trying to get that revenue to grow. They actually spent a lot of money in the summer. It's looked now it's a slightly wasted, and what will happen on the relegation. So hopefully they can get all their you know, the house in order and be all on the same page, because that's one thing you get from the Fulham supporters. They're always very, very supportive of their football club.
But it will be a difficult sell on Saturday. Is there any chance that they can hold off Man City? Will there be any sort of nothing to lose atmosphere, maybe?
It's a great game for the Fulham players. You know, I'd be looking for me sat in that dressing room thinking we're sort of, you know, it looks like there's a chance of relegation or unless there's a minor miracle, but let's go and test ourselves. Let's go and prove to everybody what we've got in this team. They've got ability, and I think the type of game Manchester City have, they'll let them play. But as we know, defensively as a unit, they're going to have to do much, much better, which we keep saying, and they haven't done that. It'll always be difficult against the City side. But what type of City side? They've had some injuries. They've all, when you go with Manchester City, they all go away for international duty, play games. So they only just started training as a there was a full group yesterday afternoon, so it'll be interesting to see where they are at the weekend.
Yeah, I did wonder that, actually, getting the early kick-off off the back of an international break when a lot of your players come back. I mean, realistically, they're probably only going to have had one full training session, because the day before a game, right, is basically tactics and set pieces, isn't it?
He'll get so much detail in. It'll have started yesterday slightly of looking at what detail he can deliver to the players. And no, that's where Pep Guardiola is the master. Mm. He's amazing at getting that detail through. So they've had a good session yesterday. They've had a couple of days off, the international players. So hopefully they'll all have been, you know, nice and fresh, ready for the game. The detail will be given to them today as normal, is what they do. But whether Fernandinho will be back is key, whether he'll risk him at this stage or whether he waits until Cardiff in the midweek.
Mm. And just finally, Michael, because there's a massive game at Wembley this weekend for one of your old clubs, Pompey. Now, we think it's going to be 80,000 people in there for Portsmouth versus Sunderland. Those Pompey fans, I used to cover a League Two club, and Pompey coming to town was always an event. What a club to play for. I wonder if you just give us a flavour of playing in front of those Portsmouth fans.
Well, I don't go back to my time in 2010. Where actually the club, the gates are closing. There's going to be no existence of Portsmouth supporters. What's going to happen? We managed to get through to the semi-final, the FA Cup, and we beat Spurs on the day. It was an amazing, you know, achievement from a club that had nothing left, was about to close, no supporters. I think that's probably one of the best atmospheres I'd ever witnessed that day of beating Spurs, because they realised that we never really got a chance of doing that. And now they thought they might have got 20,000 in the chequered trade, and they've managed to produce 40,000. Full credit to them. It'll be a special day for the Pompey supporters. I'm going to be at the game. I'm covering the game, so I can't wait to get there on Sunday.
Brilliant. Michael, thank you so much for joining us and speaking with your experience of so many different clubs as well. And have a great time at the weekend. I'm sure it'll be a really special day at Wembley.
Thanks very much.
Cheers, Michael. That's Michael Brown, ex-Spurs, Man City, Fulham, and of course Pompey midfielder. He certainly provided performances of distinction at a number of different clubs. That game at Wembley, by the way, Portsmouth versus Sunderland, 80,000 people there expected. It's going to be special, but it's the final, the Checkatrade Trophy, never deserved. Because remember, this is the controversial competition where the group stages involve under-21 teams of Premier League sides. Thank goodness it's not Tottenham under-21s against Chelsea under-21s, because we wouldn't be getting 80,000 for that.
This is Love Sport.
It's posh sports reporter Guy Watts here to talk us through some cricket. There's plenty of competition in this 10-team World Cup. What's Ashley Giles, what's your feeling about how he's feeling about it?
My feeling is that he shares our excitement, and I think as well, I don't know, I wonder if he feels a bit less pressure than you might expect from the man in this job. So in this great interview with the Mail today, it's extensive, it covers all sorts of things, but one of the first things he points out, and on the one hand it's quite touching, because he says if we do win either or both of the World Cup and the Ashes, it'll essentially be a tribute to the work that Andrew Strauss did in the post before Ashley Giles took over. Of course, he stepped down after the tragic death of his wife Ruth, and that's a very nice and thing for Ashley Giles to say, and it's right to, because Andrew Strauss has essentially reset English cricket, particularly in white ball terms, when he took over 4 years ago. But also, I think Ashley Giles knows that he won't be the man sort of vilified, if you like, if things do go wrong, because he's only been in the job a matter of months, and I think he's keen to stress that as well. He has made some changes though, and he discusses those. He stresses that Mark Ramprakash hasn't been sacked from the England setup, even though he's no longer going to be the test batting coach. Says he's still got important work to do. And what's almost more interesting is actually looking ahead. Trevor Bayliss is leaving, stepping down from the role of England coach at the end of the summer. And we know that Ashley Giles was part of the failed experiment to have split coaches between white ball and red ball cricket in the past. interesting to see he doesn't want to go back to that. He says there should be one head coach who essentially works with a specialist assistant in each of the three formats, 2020, 50 over, one day cricket.
That seems like the obvious way to do it, almost to have like a chief exec role coach who then, yeah, has those specialists. You do need that continuity, I think, because much as, yeah, we talk about split squads and, yeah, sure, the T20 squad does look different from the Test squad, but Joe Root still plays every format. Stuart Broad used to still play every format.
Well, Butler, Ben Stokes, Moeen Ali.
There's so many who do. So there's no reason you shouldn't have the same coach at least working with a common strand.
I agree. And I'm pleased to see that Ashley Giles is going with that. I think ultimately, while the idea of specialist coaches is appealing, I think when you're dealing with a national team, I think that it is good, as you say, to have a continuity of voice as well. So yeah, it's a good story, of course, of Ashley Giles sacked as the England One Day coach 5 years ago. He went away, essentially took a new career path down the more administrative route, had great success at Warwickshire, where, interestingly, of course, Paul Farbrace, the assistant until now of Trevor Bayliss with the England team, has now gone to take on that role of head of sport at Warwickshire that Ashley Giles just left. And that, I think, has actually concerned quite a lot of us cricket fans. We know how important Paul Farbrace has been to the England success recently.
Very, very popular in the
dressing room. And a very popular figure. But you know what? Ashley Giles, as Paul Newman points out in the piece, he's a popular figure as well. He smiled all the way through the interview. So he says he's here to enjoy it. And so he should. What a great job to be entrusted with, and what a great time to be entrusted with it. I don't think any of us can wait just a week, of course, until the start of the county championship now, if you can believe it.
Yes, as I was reminded on Twitter yesterday, how confident are you in England's World Cup chances of winning the whole thing? Because actually, given that they're the number one one-day side in the world, they have been one of the best one-day sides in the world for quite a long time, it's on home soil, they should win this World Cup.
Yeah, they probably should, but I wouldn't actually say I'm confident of us winning it. We have a chance, we have on paper the best chance, but I wouldn't actually make us outright favourites. I think I don't want to get ahead of myself, and I don't want to build up my own expectations too much. I think in India you've got the equal strongest team, if you like, but you've also got a team who are extremely used to winning things, whether it's in the IPL or, more importantly, at World Cup level, and England have never done that. Australia are coming back in a big way, whether or not they've got Steve Smith or David Warner. They've won their last six ODIs against India and Pakistan, no mean feat. And then the likes of New Zealand and Pakistan are extremely good when it comes to the tournaments these days, so I wouldn't be surprised to see a dark horse in there either. We're going to be up against
fifth favourites, I think you've made us there. That's proper English understatement.
We are joint favourites, but I wouldn't go as far as say I'm expecting us to win, because our history just suggests we'll mess it up at some point.
I think Australia are going to win the World Cup, and I absolutely hate it. Just hate it to pieces as far as I can. Guy Watts, Posh Sports reporter, thank you very much for all the latest cricket. We are a week away from the domestic season.
This is Love Sport.
It's time to talk about this fan protest a little bit more at Fulham, because it's important. The club have thwarted protest plans over ticket prices because of a banner ban. The banner, which has been banned, you said trying that too quickly, reportedly met club standards, but they said the decision behind banning it is that they are not supportive of the team. Let's talk to Tom Greatrix, chair of the Fulham Supporters Trust. Now, Tom, I can see both sides of this, but ultimately the club should surely let the fans protest if they want to.
Well, I think it's disappointing they took that decision personally, I love it, the club, to say that I thought that was the wrong thing to do, but it's not going to stop Fulham supporters making very clear tomorrow their feelings about the ticket pricing that's been used this season and why it's wrong and why it needs to change. So, you know, banners not being in the ground is not going to stop fans being able to make their point and make those views clear, and that's what will be happening tomorrow.
I'm a little bit surprised by this protest in some ways, because I understand it's not to do with the season ticket prices. I think about 60% of fans said they were satisfied with season ticket prices, but far more of them were dissatisfied with the match day prices. Now, surely this doesn't really affect regular season ticket holders, because they don't buy match day tickets.
No, it's true that the Fulham's season ticket prices for the equivalent home end, you know, normal home end tickets, are very, very competitive and amongst the best in the Premier League. The match day prices aren't, and the match day prices, you're right, are match day tickets are a minority in the ground. But you see, season ticket holders, as well as fans who don't have season tickets for a whole range of different reasons, personal commitments, they might live further away, you know, families, all sorts of things, all see the same thing, which is that there are people they know, people they've been to football with frequently, people who are regularly going last season, who have not been able to afford to go to many games this season. season. And the fact that survey research that we were quoting, we surveyed Fulham fans and 2,300 responded to it, demonstrates that for those people that have gone to fewer games this season, the biggest impact on that has been the price of tickets, and that's a significant change from last season, and also a change from the last time we were in the Premier League as well, going back 5 or 6 years.
But Fulham's still sold out most weeks, isn't it?
No, there have been 3 games that have sold out more than a couple of days before kickoff. Liverpool and Manchester United, which is not at all unexpected. And Manchester City, this weekend's game, sold out just last weekend. But then the club have been giving lots of tickets to local residents for some of those games. And so they haven't been able to sell out. But that, even if they were all sold out, even if every single home game was sold out at those prices, that doesn't deal with the issue that there are a lot of supporters who have been loyal to the Fulham for many years who would, if they could afford it, would go to more games, have not been able to go to as many as they want. And then when you don't do as well, as we haven't done that well this season, obviously, and if we, as it looks likely, are relegated and then playing a different division next season, they're going to have to put a lot of effort trying to entice those people back, because some of those who are there just for the Premier League games are not going to be around for watching Fulham against Luton or Fulham against Hull or whoever it is in the Championship next season.
Thank you very much for joining us and telling us about that protest. That's Tom Greatrix, chair of the Fulham Supporters Trust. They will be campaigning tomorrow to bring down the match day ticket prices, which in the cheapest end range between £45 and £60. But the club have banned their banners. Banned banners, eh? I'm not going to try and say that too much, otherwise I'll have to get Eric Banner on the show.
This is Love Sport.
We're, of course, talking about a massive weekend of Premier League fixtures. I do also want to touch on the fact that while United have made an important signing in Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, they haven't yet, and I'm surprised by this, they haven't built the structure around him yet. And sometimes that happens and these things take time, but United have been looking for a director of football for months, if not years. Honestly, they've been doing it for a long, long time. They've recognised, they've acknowledged that you can't do this without one. It's not possible. There's a reason every other Premier League club has one. Because you need them. You can't expect the managers to do it. You can't expect a non-football person like Ed Woodward, who, as everyone says, is an outstanding commercial director, but is not a football man. So you need someone who can head up that operation. And it was kind of interesting that we were looking at Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's career at Cardiff, and I know it's a world away, and it's a totally different club, but he will have learned a lot from that. And one of the things he will have learned is that recruitment is hard. Yeah, I remember him bringing in, I think, Magnus Wolf-Ikram in the January transfer window, and he looked a little bit out of his depth, to be honest, in the Premier League, and I think they brought in about 15 players over the summer, and he was soon sacked. And Solskjaer will know, and he didn't really have a very experienced technical director at the time. He had a recruitment analyst, but that was about it. And he will have learned from that that it's very hard to rebuild a team on your own. In fact, it's almost impossible, to be perfectly honest. And I think it's harsh to expect him to do so. So United need to support him. They also need to get Mike Phelan to stop doing this ridiculous balancing act. Now, Mike Phelan is widely acknowledged as one of the best coaches United's ever had. He was huge in the Alex Ferguson era, and it was a big mistake of David Moyes to get rid of him as soon as he arrived. He's acknowledged that. Fergie said it as well. Phelan's back. Solskjaer brought him back because he knew he needed that advice around him. He's got another job, though. Mike Phelan is, I believe, director of football, funnily enough, for the Central Coast Mariners in Australia. So what on earth is going on? Why on earth is he trying to balance these two jobs? Manchester United should sit him down and say, Mike, how much? Because, you know, every man has his price. And he can say, Mike, here's the chequebook. You write the number and we'll have you here for the next 3 years next to Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, and we will make United great again. Because that's what they should be doing. Without wanting to sound too much like Donald Trump. It's great. We're the best club. Ask anybody. We're the best club in the world. We're going to make United great again. It's going to be great. I've got the not bad from Mike there. The not bad head nod. That's my Donald Trump impression, if in case you didn't know. But look, United do need to do this. They've got a big game coming up against Watford, which brings me neatly on to my Premier League predictions. Producer Mike's decided it's a good opportunity for me to make an idiot of myself. It's very simple. Pick 4 Premier League fixtures from the weekend, try and predict the score, and then on Monday morning, I can humiliate myself. And when you hear me pick my scoreline, you'll hear this noise. That's me blowing away the competition, apparently. Yeah, I know, it's a bit lame, but there we go. I thought I'd pick some of the TV games as well, because realistically, you're the ones you're going to watch. Fulham Man City in the early game. Tricky one, this, because I can't work out quite how many Man City are going to score. It's going to be a lot, though. I think that's realistic. However, they're not going to have had a lot of time together. United, City are famous for preparing very, very well for games. Fulham are famous for not preparing very well for games. But it's the early kickoff. City are straight off an international break. A lot of them will have flown a lot of mileage. I think they might come in a little bit cold. So I think that Fulham might take the lead and then lose. I think Fulham are going to lose 4-1. I mean, that does assume Fulham are going to score against City, the champions. So I don't know. I can just see them nicking an early one and then it all going to pieces and it all being very miserable. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, he's at the wheel at Old Trafford this weekend. His first game as permanent manager. I'm sure it'll be an electric atmosphere, but they've got a bit of a challenge on their hands. Watford are not an easy side to beat. They've made that perfectly clear this season. They've played some decent football. They've got a very physical team. And I think that might make life a little bit tricky for United at Old Trafford. I don't think it's going to be anything like a cakewalk. Watford have struggled away from home, frankly. They went to their last two games have been Liverpool and City, and they've lost it an aggregate of 8-1. But I just think they might be able to find something a little bit different at Old Trafford. I still think they'll lose, but I think it'll only be 2-1 to United. The late game. The late TV game. I sort of said to myself, I have to pick the Saturday TV games. Unfortunately, Saturday's TV games, West Ham-Everton, the inconsistency derby. So West Ham have traditionally had Everton as a bit of a bogey team, but part of that was because Romelu Lukaku has the most absurd goal-scoring record against them. I think he's got 11 in 10 games against West Ham in the Premier League, which is completely ridiculous. I really am struggling to call this, but I don't think West Ham are very good defensively. I think that's the key. There's a lot of talk about Issa Diop and how he's very good. Balbuena, when he's fit, is decent as well. But I don't really think that West Ham are that good defensively. They will ship goals. I think it's going to be 2-2 West Ham Everton. Which brings me on to probably the biggest game. Well, it's definitely the biggest game of the weekend, isn't it? It's Liverpool Spurs, the last game on Sunday, the last game of March. It's so big for Liverpool to get a result here. It's absolutely massive because remember those run of draws, the West Ham and the Leicester games, where they were nervous. There's no two ways about it. They were nervous. West Ham got at them, and that was troubling. Leicester just sat back on a cold, snowy night and let Liverpool try and play. And frankly, I don't think they did brilliantly well. I'm struggling to pick this one. If I were Tottenham manager, I think I would go out and try and get after Liverpool at Anfield, because they are going to be a little bit nervous. It's a massive game. City are probably going to have smashed Fulham the day before, puts the pressure back on Liverpool to try and get the win. And I think if Tottenham came out at them, they could get a win. However, I don't think that's Pochettino's style. I think he will sit off them. I think Liverpool are going to be nervous on the ball. Rather pessimistically, I'm actually going for a 0-0 in that game. A stalemate at Anfield. We will, of course, come back on Monday and I will have got those staggeringly wrong.
Love Sports.
It's time to talk to Love Sports tennis correspondent, who hopefully isn't as tongue-tied as I am today. It's Abigail Johnson. Good afternoon, Abigail.
Hi, James. How are you?
Well, struggling, clearly. I just can't get my words out. I don't know what's wrong with me. Thank goodness it's Friday, eh? Now, I want to talk to you a little bit about the Hopman Cup, or at least what used to be the Hopman Cup, the new men-only, as it's described here, ATP World Team Cup. It's going to be held in that January slot before the Australian Open across Perth, Sydney and Brisbane. Now, this has been lauded as a decent idea in terms of the tournament itself, but obviously it cuts the women out, so I imagine that's been pretty unpopular.
Yeah, and I mean, the Hopman Cup is such a unique event, you know. There's not, well, there isn't an event outside of the Grand Slams that brings men's and women's tennis together and does so successfully. I mean, we've had big name moments in the Hopman Cup over the past few years. Serena Williams and Roger Federer were on court facing each other this year. Federer's been a regular presence at the event for the past few years. And generally, it's just a really interesting event to watch because a lot of the top players are drawn to competing there at the beginning of the year in order to get match play under their belt without the high pressure situation of playing for points, playing for prize money. So yeah, it's definitely a big loss at the beginning of the season because it really adds some extra flavour in there with the tennis that's going on.
Is there any sense that the tennis community is up in arms about this? I mean, it feels pretty poor to be losing a decent bit of women's tennis for a male-only competition.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, at the beginning of the year when, I mean, this has just been announced officially, but it was kind of in the mix, I guess, at the beginning of the year. And there was talk about that possibly being the last edition of the Hotman Cup, at least in Perth. And then the news about the ATP Cup came out soon after. And for me, the biggest issue here is that the ATP Cup, which is a team event with countries for men's tennis, where they will play in several round-robin groups and then there will be a knockout stage, is a virtual replica of another tournament that's taking place at the end of the season, which is the revamped Davis Cup, the World Cup of Tennis Finals, run by Gerard Piqué. And these two events are taking place now within a couple of months of each other, and it's pretty much the same event with a slightly different format. Now, I understand having either one or the other, but I feel like it's a bit of a pride thing for them to both be running the tournaments because there's not much difference between them. And if some players play one at the end of the year, they're not likely to play the other one at the beginning of the year. So both tournaments as well are losing out on big names. And I think it's come at the expense of a really good and unique tournament in the Hotman Cup.
And the word expense is the key, isn't it? It's basically a big money grab by various different bodies just trying to cash in on team tennis, which they know is a good product, but they can't figure out where to put it in the schedule. Speaking of the schedule, of course, there is always top-level tennis going on, it would seem. We're in the midst of the Miami Open, through to the semi-finals. Two Canadians, one in each half of the semi-finals. It's a bright era for Canadian tennis, isn't it?
Oh, it truly is. I mean, Bianca Andreescu, obviously the 18-year-old wild card, won Indian Wells on the women's side. And now we've got Denis Shapovalov and Felix Auger-Aliassime, two really good friends as well, on the rise. They played each other at the US Open last year, and Felix had to pull out with cramp. It was very unfortunate because that was starting to be a great match. But no, both of them have amazing all-court tennis, firepower, different elements of their game that stand out. I mean, Auger-Aliassime was incredible at the net in his most recent match. Shapovalov striking really deep, you know, opening up the court. So, I mean, it's not impossible to think that we might have two Canadian teenagers in the final, but they've got some stiff competition to come through together.
Which of those two do you think? Because, you know, we both know George Belshaw well, and he co-hosts the Love Tennis podcast with me, and he has been talking about Felix Auger-Aliassime for a while as someone who could be, you know, a top 10 player. Which of these two young Canadians do you think has more potential to, say, win a Grand Slam?
It's so difficult because Shapovalov started rising before Auger-Aliassime. He's a bit older as well. So he beat Nadal, I think, at the age of 17, 18. It was last year, actually. So he would have been probably about 18 years old. And he definitely burst onto the scene more quickly. But Auger-Aliassime, you know, I've had my eye on him for probably about a year now. And he plays with such firepower. And he plays with maturity beyond his years as well, you know. And I think, in terms of general weapons, each of them have a good finishing shot. You know, they have all-court ability. I'd be inclined to go with Auger-Aliassime, who I can see kind of going further out of the two of them. But, you know, both of them have so many weapons and are just such exciting players. I can see them both winning Grand Slams at the end of the day.
Now, Shapovalov has got to beat Roger Federer if he wants to get into the final of the Miami Open. He's talked about it, you know, the stakes are so high. It's a semi-final of a Masters 1000 against your idol, a dream come true. Now, that's not what people who beat Federer say before they play Federer. That's what they say before they lose 2-1, isn't it? Just doesn't he need to be a bit grittier and try and beat Roger rather than just adore him?
I think that once he gets onto the court, he will leave that behind and go into that competitive mindset. I mean, you've got Naomi Osaka, who absolutely adores Serena Williams, but she's had little trouble with her, really, in the two times that she's faced her. So I think that once you get onto the match court, you kind of try and put out of your mind who it is that you're playing. And Shapovalov, you know, he's beaten Nadal, he's beaten big names on big stages, and he's risen on the competition, on the energy from the crowd, which I'm sure will be around. We saw when Stefanos Tsitsipas beat Federer at the Australian Open. There was such a great atmosphere there. And it shows to the other younger guys, you know, that these results aren't impossible. So, maybe he shouldn't have been that easygoing with his quotes ahead of the match. I mean, Federer, I'm sure, will be listening with interest. But once he gets on court, Shapovalov, I'm sure that he'll be very much in the moment of the competition.
You've got a 1 in 4 chance, Abigail. Who do you think is going to win the Miami Open?
Oh, man. Well, I mean, I've got to say, it's hard to bet against Federer, especially with the way he lost Indian Wells when technically he should have won that tournament. I'm not sure he'll let that happen again, let it slip out of his grasp the way he did. So it's a safe bet as Roger Federer, and I'll have to back him.
Yeah. Controversial pick from Abigail Johnson. Backs Roger Federer to win tennis tournament. Thank you so much for joining us. That's Love Tennis, Love Sports tennis correspondent Abigail Johnson there, backing Roger Federer to win yet another title. And of course, we have lost, remember, the Hopman Cup, and it's worth touching upon because I thought it was an unusual tournament. It's sort of an exhibition tournament. You know, it's mixed. You play men's singles, then women's singles, then mixed doubles in a team format. It was a strange tournament, but it somehow felt like a good way to ease into the year. And it got big crowds. You know, they got 22,000 people watching those matches. It put Serena and Roger on the same court. And if that's not good for tennis, I don't know what is.
Love Sport.
There's so much to be excited about today. But producer Mike in the control room, who I can only see through two layers of reinforced glass, just keeps fist pumping at random moments. I think he just remembers that it's Friday and he just celebrates. But of course, the weekend means the Premier League's back. It also means the Premier League's back on telly. And the late game is West Ham versus Everton, a game dubbed the Inconsistency Derby. It's a tough one to pick. Maybe there's a man who can pick it for us. It's Paul McParland, senior writer at These Footy Times. Is this going to be a battle of who cannot lose this game, Paul?
Yeah, I think, James, I like your term there, the inconsistency derby, because I think for both sides, Everton in particular, it's been a very, very inconsistent season. I think, as ever, the key factor for Everton will be whether the defence can be consistent enough to try and get a result at West Ham.
That defence, I mean, obviously we've almost seen nothing of Yerry Mina, who had such a big World Cup and I think people were quite excited about. We haven't seen any of him, though.
No, I mean, he's made very few appearances for the club this season. And, of course, he's been away on international duty this week. He's picked up a hamstring injury, so he's not going to be available on Saturday anyway.
It's just curious to me. I wonder whether there's more to it. I mean, he obviously has had a couple of injuries. Who are we going to see starting at centre-half in his place then?
Well, I think Kurt Zouma will be back on the side again. I mean, Kurt's had a good season for Everton, so he's an adequate replacement. So I don't think there's too many worries on that score at the moment.
Which way do you think this game is going to go? Or at least how do you think it'll unfold? Will it be a case of Everton just coming and trying to keep things tight for an hour?
Well, we haven't really done that much this season. Under Marco Silva, the sides adopted a much more attacking approach, you know, particularly in away games. So I can see Everton going for it from the start. The last away game in Newcastle, we went for it from the start, and we were cruising 2-0 up at half-time. And then those defensive inconsistencies and frailties came back to haunt us in the second half. So my view would be that I think, you know, we'll try and hit West Ham from the start, in particular because West Ham's last home game, they conceded 3 against Huddersfield. So bearing that in mind, I don't see there's any sense or logic in sitting back.
We've talked a lot about Jordan Pickford over the last few weeks, and I know that there is a split in Everton fans. Some think he's fine, and some think actually, if there's big offers coming in for him, take them and run because he's not as good as people think he is. Where do you stand on that?
Well, I think with Jordan, he's 25. You know, he's a young keeper. He's only going to get better. And you know, people saying get rid of him, take the money, bring somebody else in. I'm not sure who you'd bring in who would be better than him. You know, he's a brilliant shot stopper. He's been slightly inconsistent this season. Maybe it's been a reaction to the World Cup or the success that he's had. But the last one or two games, he showed a bit more consistency. And I think the majority of Everton fans are happier seeing Jordan Pickford in goal, you know, at the moment than any other viable alternatives at the club.
I was interested to read today an interview with Marco Silva saying he's in it for the long haul. I'm the stability that this club also needs. Do you think that they will give him a long haul? And do you think he's right? Is he the bloke that the right time, the right man at the right time?
Well, that's the $1 million question, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think with Silva, The owner, Mr. Moscardi, made a huge call in bringing him in because his previous two clubs, Watford and Hull, he didn't exactly set the world alight. But obviously, they saw something there that they liked. Personally, at this stage, I can't see there's any point in Everton changing the manager. I think he needs to be given two or three seasons, a few transfer windows behind them to get the squad that he wants. I think one thing I would say, those results have been inconsistent this season. The standard of football and the style of football has been so much superior to what we suffered under Sam Allardyce that I think just on that score alone, I think most people would be prepared to give them a lot longer in the post. And although results haven't been as good as what we hoped, I think no team from the top six has outplayed Everton this season, apart from Tottenham Hotspur. We performed well at Anfield, we performed well at Old Trafford, we performed well at Stamford Bridge. And I think there are signs there that he's starting to bring in a style of play that, with a bit more consistency, could see us back challenging more towards the 6th, 7th, 8th position again.
Do you think we'll see a summer where they will go out and spend a little bit as well? Because, I mean, obviously he's been relatively well backed in places, not always correctly, but will they strengthen some areas, and what might those areas be over the summer?
Yeah, I think the answer to that has to be yes. I think Silva's record in the transfer market, I think, has been quite good this summer compared to some of the other sort of ineffectual players that were brought in by likes of Allardyce. I mean, St. Lucas Digne has been a revelation left back. And Richarlison has been provided the goals for. He looks a threat every time he's on the ball. So we've been quite impressed with his dealing so far in the transfer market. Undoubtedly, we need a goal scoring forward. I heard in your show you mentioned before about Romelu Lukaku's scoring record against West Ham. Someone who could provide that number of goals a season is an absolute must for Everton. Mm. So that's the one area we definitely need strengthening is up front, the goalkeeper position.
I was going to say you've just given me such a ringing endorsement of Jordan Pickford. Paul Times caught up with us, well, to leave it there, but just quickly, what was your prediction for the score this weekend?
Well, I think like you, I think there's going to be a few goals in it, and with my blue sleeve on, I'd have to say that Everton to win 2-1.
All right, OK, I'll take your word for it, Paul. That's Paul McParland, senior writer at These Footy Times, predicting a 2-1 win for Everton away at West Ham this weekend. That is, of course, the late game on telly, the 5:30 kickoff, the inconsistency derby, as we're calling it here on Love Sport today. Now, it's important that Tottenham as well go into their new stadium on the right footing. They, of course, have a tough trip to Anfield on Sunday before coming home, and I mean that very literally, coming home to their new stadium to take on Palace. Mauricio Pochettino has been talking today. He says their new stadium is the best in the world, and he says it was worth all the hassle of playing at Wembley.
I think it's amazing. I think everyone was surprised about the magnitude of the project. The stadium is the best on the world. We can confirm now all that the inconvenient in the last few years, I think, pay off when you be there.
Best stadium in the world confirmed, apparently. That's what Pochettino is saying. It may well be. It's certainly much better than the Emirates. It's bigger. There's more seats. They've got but the trophy cabinet. I know that there is a running joke going on the other side of the glass to do with Tottenham's trophy cabinet. They, as I say, travel to Anfield on Sunday afternoon. I don't see that game being a thriller, sadly, but they will not want to go into that Palace game. You know, if they get beaten 4-0 by Liverpool, as can happen, we know that if that front three breaks a side open, it can be an absolute goal fest. They will not want to go into that Palace game on the back of a result like that when they've then got to play Manchester City a few days later in the Champions League quarter-final. So I think Tottenham have to be a little wary of moving into this new stadium. I'm not saying that they should be cautious in the way that they play, but there is an added element here, and you want to try and play games in isolation. The reason players always bang on about, oh, I'm just taking every game one at a time, mate, yes, game two halves. The reason they always say that is because if you're playing in a game and you're thinking about the implications of it, you can't fully focus on what you're doing. And the problem with moving into the new stadium is it adds another different element. It's hard enough playing football at that level. It's a difficult sport. It's a difficult skill. But when you add in, oh my goodness, it's the new stadium, we've got to get a result today, it's like playing golf when you're trying to hit the ball too hard. You end up skewing it away. Relax, swing easy, and let it come. Tottenham can't think about the new stadium, even if they want to.
This is Love Sport.
Raymond van Barneveld, as I mentioned in the headlines, announced his immediate retirement yesterday. It appears that the word retire has lost its meaning. Seriously, sportsmen and women just seem to chuck it around these days to replace the phrase "I'm tired" or "I'm sad" or "I lost." Instead, you just say "I'm retiring." Now, Barney's career, if indeed it had ended last night, would have ended with a not with a bang, but with a whimper. He was playing for the second night in a row in front of an adoring crowd in Rotterdam. It should have been a bang, a doubleheader in front of a home crowd. He won just two legs out of the 16 he played. He lost 7-1 both nights. It was ugly. Barney shouldn't even have been in the Premier League, realistically. It's an invitational tournament for, by most parts, and he'd already lost all semblance of the once great skills he had. Having announced that 2019 would be his last year, of course, earlier this year. And last night, he was knocked out of the Premier League darts, and he promptly said, "I need to retire. This makes no sense. I don't care anymore. If you play like this in front of a beautiful crowd, why would you continue? I have to dig very deep to show my best game, and then I show this. It's tough. I've made the decision. I'm done now. I don't want the pain anymore. It's good to see that everyone loves you, but they don't have one single clue what I'm going through. It's tough. Fine, it happens. It does. I do get it. Time catches up with you a bit more quickly than you expect sometimes, especially when you've already decided that you're going to go. We've all done it, by the way. If you've ever wanted to leave your job, you know that for the most part, you still try and do it as best you can. But once you've handed in your notice, either to resign or to go to your new job, you just start phoning it in. Everything gets harder. It's so difficult to turn up on time and do your job properly. It's tough to be professional, basically. I mean, producer Mike can barely be professional and he isn't leaving. Well, not as far as I know. So it is difficult. He's handed in his notice. He's playing badly. He wants to go and he says, "This is awful, I'm off." But then late last night, his agent intervenes, presumably sniffing a few hefty lost paydays, and says, "Oh, Raymond's having a weekend off and on Tuesday we'll sit together. I expect he will continue his career." Well, so lucrative are these opportunities that they didn't even wait until Tuesday. This lunchtime, Barney said, "I realise I should not speak out like that when I feel such raw emotion. I want to end my career at Ali Pali during one final world championship." I wonder if there was a checkbook involved. Honestly, what a waste of everyone's time that was. We were going to do a Barney tribute today. We're not going to do a Barney tribute anymore, are we? Because he's not retiring. Or not, at least, today. It's not genuine, is it? It sort of questions all of the genuity of sportsmen. He's by no means the first, let's be fair. He's not the first, and he's not the most heinous non-retirer of the lot. Conor McGregor retired from MMA 3 days ago to sell whiskey, as far as I can tell. It's not even the first time he's retired. He last did it in 2016, and then, of course, came back. And by the way, he's back in training today, in a boxing gym, still fighting. So I don't think this retirement's real either. It's a publicity stunt. And combat sports are particularly bad for it. Maybe because they relish the soap opera of the whole thing a little bit more than anyone else. But it's still utterly cynical and utterly moronic. David Haye, I think he retired twice, but perhaps three times. Honestly, Floyd Mayweather comes out of retirement anytime he hears someone opening a checkbook. Nigel Benn and Chris Eubank Sr. are both the wrong side of 50, and they're threatening to get back into the ring. It's absolute madness. I get that retirement is hard, especially when you feel just young enough to think you could still be doing it well. But have the decency, have the self-awareness and the respect for the fans and the sport to consider it. See the mistakes that have gone before you, of course, and do it right. If you want a good example, look at Nico Rosberg. This guy had had a decent career in Formula One. He, of course, came from a famous racing family. His dad, Keke Rosberg, a world champion. And he fought all his career to get in a car where he could actually win a world title. He finally got him one, and Lewis Hamilton beat him to it. And then, at long last, at the age of 31, he won a world title. It was brilliant. It was such drama. In Abu Dhabi, Lewis Hamilton ignoring team orders, trying to win the world title, and Nico Rosberg hung on. He won the race, and he won the title. And then, he had a massive booze up, and 5 days later he said, "Oh, and by the way, I'm retiring." He rode off into the sunset with his wife and his kid, and he never looked back. And that's what you have to do. At some point, you say, "You know what? I'm not able to do this to the best of my ability anymore." And Barney had that moment 4 months ago. Barney's had a massive career. He's one of the legends of darts. I don't even really like darts and I like Barney. But he must have known when he said, "Look, I'm going to retire in a year and a bit's time." He said that because he was on his last legs, almost literally. Says he's been in pain all this time, and I'm sure that's partly physical as well as mental, and as well as the humiliation of losing. But Barney, please, do it the right way. Retire right, and retire once, and retire for good.
This is Love Sport.
You've been listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 till 3pm on Love Sport Radio. And don't forget to leave us a rating and a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.